to all of the fathers in our audience, happy Father's Day. Happy Father's Day. And we appreciate you so much for your influence for good in our lives. And in conjunction with that, I want to pose a question for us to consider this morning. Fathers and others, how do you define success? What does that mean to you? How do you know when you have reached that pinnacle of success? How would you define it? I read about a fourth grade class in which the teacher introduced a game. It's called Balloon Stomp. And they blow up a balloon and they tie it to the leg of each child. And they gave the instructions that in this game, they were to step on other people's balloons. And the last one who was able to protect his balloon and keep it from being popped was the winner. And so everybody had a balloon tied around their ankle and they began the game. Sounds painful to me already, doesn't it to you? And it didn't take but a few seconds for a winner to be declared. And though some were trying to hang on to the wall and try not to get their balloon stomped on, sure enough, after just a few seconds, there was a winner. And the winner was the most disliked kid in the class. Well, there was a second group of students that were given instructions as to play this game. This group of students was developmentally challenged. But the same instructions were given and the game commenced. But what those students understood was that the balloons were to be popped. And instead of viewing one another as enemies, they viewed the balloons as enemies. And so one little girl, for example, took her balloon and held it so that a little boy could step on that balloon. And then when he did, he held his balloon so she could stomp on it. And finally, every person's balloon had been popped, and everyone cheered, because in their eyes, everyone had won. My question is this: who played the game right, and who played the game wrong? And the answer depends completely on how you keep score. How do you keep score? And success is consistent with the way that you keep score in life. I want us to think a few moments this morning about the God called success. It's a God, a false God that served so prevalently in our society. Many are seeking to be successful in their careers, in their pursuits. And many serve this God, the God called success, instead of the one true God of heaven. But as we explore this God called success, let's destroy some myths about success. And the first one is this, that success confers greatness. Success confers greatness. You see, each of us, each and every one of us, has a tremendous longing for significance. We want to know that our lives matter. And we're told in our society that if we achieve greatness, then our lives really count for something. If we can achieve that greatness. This, however, is based upon a false premise that says that great-at-ness is the same thing as greatness. There's a new word for us. Many believe great-at-ness is the same thing as greatness. Because the truth is, in so many cases in our world, it's great-at-ness that's called greatness. But there's much difference. What we call success in our culture is great-at-ness. You're really great at throwing a football. You're really great at making sales. You're great at designing software. You're great at, you fill in the blanks, because there's so many blanks and so many views of what success is when you're great at something. And the world says, well, that's greatness. No, it's great atness. And we need to understand the difference. Because there are serious problems with the pursuit of great atness. First one is that many will find it unattainable. Unattainable. If you know me well, you know I love basketball. And I will confess, there's probably a time in my life when I dreamed I'd be right up there with Michael Jordan. Or LeBron James, if you don't remember Michael Jordan. And when I was playing out on the driveway and shooting baskets, and in my mind I heard the announcers, 2 seconds left, Sergeant pulls up for the jumper. And if it missed, well, it goes into overtime. But I'd go through that scenario, and I thought, one day, I'm going to play professional basketball. It didn't take me long to realize, for me, that was unattainable. Some may say, well, I wasn't willing to put forth the effort and all the time that's required, and you're right. But there are many that may have serious dreams of great atness, but there are so few when it comes to sports, for example, that really reach that pinnacle of great atness. And so many times, if that's where we base our definition of success, we're going to find it unattainable. But then it's also unsustainable. I mentioned Michael Jordan. I could mention Larry Bird. I could even go back and mention Pistol Pete Maravich. And some of you don't have a clue of who I'm talking about. And there's some that don't dribble the ball anymore. They don't shoot anymore. And the point is that, yes, they were great in their time, but over time their abilities waned and someone else came in that had as equal or greater abilities, it could be argued. And we're not able, if our definition of success is being great at something, we're just not going to be able to sustain it. So we're tempted to view ourselves as unsuccessful. But notice this also about great atness. The biggest problem is that if and when we do reach that plateau of great atness, we find it unsatisfying. And let me give you an example. Lee Strobel is an author. He was an infidel that studied about Christ and became a believer. And he's written a couple of books, The Case for Christ, The Case for Faith. He has served as an editor for the Chicago Tribune and has won many awards in writing for that newspaper. And he tells in his book, The Case for Christ, that he was working at the Chicago Tribune and went down the hall to the newspaper's library in order to retrieve an article. This is before computers, to retrieve an article that he'd written a year before to help him with an article that he was currently working on. And so he was taken by the librarian to a huge file cabinet, and she gave this explanation. We take one copy of every article, and we file it away under the name of the reporter who wrote it. And she pulled out a shallow file drawer, and inside were rows packed with envelopes that were stamped Lee Strobel. And she said, "These are your articles." Lee Strobel wrote, "I had a strange sensation as I looked inside that drawer. Here was the substance of my entire life's work at the Tribune. Suddenly it struck me. This is what I'm killing myself for? I'm trading my life for a drawer of neatly folded newspaper clippings that are turning brittle and yellowing around the edges? At that moment, it didn't seem like a fair trade. I was getting ripped off. But here is someone who was very successful in the eyes of the world and had won awards for his writings, only to find them in a filing cabinet." And I think that illustrates this same point. In so much of what society defines as greatness, it's unsatisfying. It doesn't bring us all that we thought it would. That's if we define success by great atness. But notice, secondly, another myth that we need to destroy is that Jesus condemns greatness. There's two passages I'd like for us to consider this morning. The first one is Mark chapter 9. In my Bible, they're in the same opening. In Mark chapter 9, beginning with verse 33. Listen to what, and this is the passage that Glenn read for us earlier. They came to Capernaum. When Jesus was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet, because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Don't you know Jesus knew that? But they've been arguing along the road as before they get into the house, which one of them is greatest. James says, "I am." John says, "I am." Peter says, "I'm the greatest." But sitting down, verse 35, Jesus called the 12 and said, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." Another occasion, Mark chapter 10, beginning with verse 35. I mentioned James and John because on this occasion they're wanting places of prominence. They have this request of Jesus, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." And he said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said, "Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory." Again, places of prominence. Jesus asks some questions they really don't understand. "Are you able to be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink?" I believe he has reference there to the suffering that he was about to undergo. That cup was the cup of the wrath of God against sin as he would hang on the cross in the not too distant future. That baptism was the baptism of suffering, how he would be overwhelmed by the pain and agony, not only physically but spiritually, of paying the price for the sins of the world. And he told him, "You will suffer," in so many words. "But to grant those positions, that's not mine to give." But James and John, and perhaps they've been intentional about this, they've said it and the other 10 apostles hear them. How do you think they feel about that? Mark tells us that they were angry about, they became indignant. They were angry with James and John. Perhaps it was jealousy. Perhaps it was because Peter and Andrew, some of the others, wanted those places of prominence. But then Jesus takes this opportunity to talk about true greatness. He called them to himself, verse 42, and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever desires to be first shall be slave." Doulos. We'll talk more about that later. Doulos, slave of all. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." He doesn't condemn greatness. Jesus clarifies it. And he points out in the world, just like we're doing this morning, in the world you're going to find many, many definitions of success, of greatness. But he says you want to know what true greatness is, not in the sight of the world, but in the sight of God. It's being a servant of all. Mark 10:43 again. "Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant." So how do you keep score? What's your definition of success? What's your definition of greatness? Where do you find significance? Jesus here is defining greatness for us, and he reminds us that in the end, all that matters is God's score, not our own. In his book, Quiet Strength, Tony Dungy, head coach of the 2007 Super Bowl champion Indianapolis Colts, wrote of what was in his mind with 45 seconds left on the clock, and he recognized his team was about to win the Super Bowl. And he was going to have an opportunity on the platform to say something to 100 million people for 30 seconds. And he thought about, what am I going to say? And this is part of what he said. When it came time to speak, Dungy said, "It's great to win the Super Bowl, but it's certainly not the most important thing in my life. You can have it all and not have anything if you don't have the Lord in your life." Wait a second. Winning the Super Bowl. That's the pinnacle of success in the National Football League. But here's the head coach of the winning team saying, it's not worth anything. That score is not the one that counts. What counts is if you have the Lord in your life. So what is this true greatness then that Jesus is trying to get us to understand? What does it mean to be successful? In a statement, here it is. True greatness is serving God by serving others. That's success. Serving God by serving others. Jesus, in answer to the question, who is my neighbor, told the well-known story, the beloved parable of the Good Samaritan. How this man that was headed from Jerusalem to Jericho fell among thieves, was beaten, left for dead. And a priest and a Levite both passed by, but they passed by on the other side. They didn't stop and render aid to this man. But then a Samaritan, a hated Samaritan by the Jews, was the one who saw this man in his time of need and went to him and bandaged his wounds and carried him on his own animal to an inn and even paid some extra hotel fare. Which of these three proved to be the neighbor to this man? And the one, even probably ashamed to say the word Samaritan, said, he who showed mercy on him. Jesus said, go and do likewise. We call him the Good Samaritan. But in Jesus' definition of success, we should call him the Great Samaritan. The Great Samaritan. He served God by serving others. Martin Luther King Jr. said, everybody can be great because anybody can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and verb agree to serve. You only need a heart full of grace, a soul generated by love. But notice this, Jesus defines greatness as using your great atness to bless other people. Again, our great atness may not be something that the world views as great. But each of us has our great atness in that all of us have been given talents and abilities. And what Jesus is teaching us is to use those things, use those blessings from God in service to God by serving others. You may be great at listening. Use that gift to the glory of God and in service to others. You may be great at relating to teenagers. You may be great at noticing when someone is hurting. You may be great at giving. Whatever you're great at, greatness is using these things